Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. It's 7 past 1 on a Tuesday afternoon. You're listening to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Today in the hour, we're going to be crossing over to our correspondents, Ranjeni, who is in KwaZulu-Natal at the moment, and Rebecca Davis, who is covering the F.W. de Klerk conference on 25 years of the unbanning of political parties in South Africa. But at the top of the hour, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about some youth issues. And I'm joined in studio by a special guest, NK Make Your Marks Chief Operating Officer Kingsley Kapuri. Welcome.
Thanks, Greg. Big fan of the show. Happy to be here.
So we're talking about youth issues. Tell us, what does NK Make Your Mark do?
So NK is a youth development organization. And what we do is we work with young people from across the country and get them to be agents of positive social change wherever they are.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds pretty
simple. But how do you do it?
It's a lot more fun than I'm making it sound. So what we do is we get young people from across the country. Our target group is between 15 and 30, but largely high school age. Mm-hmm. And the question we ask is what's bugging you about your community? What's frustrating you? What's exciting you about you want to be a part of? And we really challenge them to be part of the solution for these issues. So if it's education, if it's issues around garbage collection, if it's
sanitation, teenage pregnancy, drugs,
absolutely all the issues you're naming, and we think young people are best placed to take action on these issues, so mm-hmm. we challenge them to mm-hmm. do so.
We all know about sort of the youth problem in South Africa, you know, unemployment, poor education levels, and we all know something needs to change. But how do you actually help them improve their own communities? How do you actually do it?
Okay, so just to run you through how the cycle works. So first thing is we identify young people that already have an eye for, an eye for sort of social action.
So people who are not
necessarily the nerds. Funny enough, it's actually people who are often involved in community. So people who are playing for their soccer teams but frustrated that they don't have a pitch, or mm-hmm. people that like computers but don't have any computers. So it's not necessarily the nerds. And we bring these young people together from across the country. So across the socioeconomic divide, across, you know, geographic boundaries, and we bring them together. So we've got this melting pot of excitement and sort of.
Okay. You bring them together, but what do you do? Do they go to school together? How does it work then?
So what happens is we've got a week long of what we call a forum. Mm-hmm. And what happens at this forum is we start to brainstorm issues. What's frustrating your community? What do you want to do something about? And then we move from this frustration and we move into project plans. It's like, okay, so we've established that there are things we want to change. What are we going to do about it? And we start this process of brainstorming what these people are going to do when they get back to their communities.
Mm-hmm. Now we've heard there are a lot of these programs around the country in various formats, you know, whether it might focus on something specific like photography or whether it might just be like a young leadership conference or something like that. What is different about NK? Because I've heard a lot of positive things about it.
So I'd say if we were to identify what makes us different, I think the first is we're non-prescriptive. So we don't think that HIV/AIDS is the biggest issue or unemployment is the biggest issue. Not to say that these are not important, but we think the people on the ground should decide what's most prevalent. So the biggest issue in Bochum in Limpopo is different from the biggest issues in Mayfair and Gauteng. Mm-hmm. So we let the young people decide for themselves what's the biggest issue in your community. So mm-hmm. one thing is definitely that we're non-prescriptive. The second thing is support. So it's not just go change the world, have a great time, take some pictures. But when they go back into their communities, we support them. Mm-hmm. So we make sure that for at least the next 9 months, after they leave the forum, that we're on the phone with them, on WhatsApp, on Facebook, doing site visits to make sure that they feel they have the emotional and technical support to actually do something, because it takes a lot of guts to go out there mm-hmm. at 15 years old and change a community. So we make sure that we're with them the whole way.
This week we've seen what happened in the Kuro school, where certain school children are being segregated according to race. And we know that across the country, there, even amongst children, there are a lot of divides by either race, class, ethnicity, anything like that. And you mentioned that NK gets these school children from across the whole country and from different classes, right?
Absolutely.
What sort of benefit does that give these guys, and how does that work? Is it hard for them to get along, and how does it work with all these different kids from different backgrounds coming together and trying to spend a week together?
Okay, absolutely. So just as you mentioned, so part of our mission is to connect across the socioeconomic divide. And I think the benefit of that is for people to realize they're not so different. I mean, it sounds, you know, so we are the world, let's hold hands. But the truth is, they realize, listen, we're all 15, we're all kind of into the same things, you know. The boys all like girls, the girls are all doing their thing. So we're not so different.
Not all the boys like girls.
Okay, it's just, let's just jump that. But the focus is, and what I think brings them together in our unique context, is that they all They all want to improve whatever situations they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And we what's also encouraging to see is a lot of the students from Model C schools, ex-Model C schools, and even so-called privileged backgrounds also still are looking into their communities, their schools, and saying, what can we do to make this better? So it's not purely about people from underprivileged backgrounds making things better. It's about all South Africans coming together to improve their community. So that's really something that we see.
Mm-hmm. So you get all these young people from across the country, bring them together, help them focus on these positive issues.
Yeah.
But how do you know that they're actually doing something, and what do they do? Do you have any examples of what they actually do to help their communities?
Yes, absolutely. We focus a lot of our energy on our monitoring and evaluation, which is, how do we know these guys are actually starting projects? How do we know the impact of these projects? So we've got a team that spends time tracking them and getting monthly updates from the young people. So an example of some of sort of our star projects that have come through. So one is the Prides movement, started by two young people, Avumile and Kosana, in the Eastern Cape. And they came to the NK Forum and they really loved the energy and excitement they felt there, and they wanted to pass it on. So they partnered with a local high school in their community, and they're running personal development classes for their primary school, for their local primary school. So working to, you know, over 50 primary school students, and already at that young age, instilling values they think are important, like respect and integrity and so on, things that were not being discussed at a primary school level before. So we really put a big emphasis on making sure that there's a follow-on from what we do.
Mm-hmm. And obviously there must be an identified gap in what needs to change in youth issues in South Africa. When this organization was formed, what sort of gaps did you want to address particularly?
So I think one thing was the issue of apathy. This idea that young people have to wait for somebody else, for an older person or person in a position of power, or somebody with money, or somebody else to come and do it for them. So that's a big focus of what we do. As much as we're not focusing on a particular socioeconomic issue, we are focusing on this idea that young people can take their future into their own hands and focus on that.
And we've just had a question come in on the issue of finances. We've seen a lot of NGOs in the last few years really struggle, and some even close down, particularly when things like USAID or PEPFAR withdrew money and certain foreign donors redirected money out of South Africa towards other African countries. How does NK Make Your Mark get its funding?
You're right. 2012, 2013 was a really tough year, and we had some good nonprofits doing some great work. And they're retrenching most of their staff or closing down completely. So that's been a big issue in the sector, and something we're looking at. In terms of NK specifically, so our funding is mostly local. So that's a lot of CSI from a lot of the local banks and businesses in the private sector. We do have some aid funding that's coming from outside the country, but that's sort of a smaller portion of our funding. But it's a constant challenge, as you've mentioned. Mm.
Okay, still on the issue of youth, we're going to cross over to Cape Town right now and speak to a young man, Rafael Maneta, who is part of the Live VIP campaign, and that is Voting is Power. And they are sort of young people, for young people, creating content on particularly issues of politics. And Rafiwa's been with those guys for a little while, and he's their parliamentary correspondent. Are you with us, Rafiwa?
Yeah, yeah. What's up, Chris?
I am. Good. How are you doing?
Not too bad, man. Yourself?
I'm good, thanks. So Rafiwa, can you tell us a bit about what you do, for what the Voting is Power campaign does, and what you do down there at Parliament?
Okay, sweet. So I work for a company called Liberty Africa. We're a youth content agency. And one of the platforms we have is a platform called Live Medicine. It's a youth-run website. And one of the streams of content we do is the VIP. That's called Voting is Power. So it's just about getting young people engaged in politics, getting them involved in the, you know, democratic process. So one of the projects we're working on right now is Live from Parliament. And that's a sort of campaign where we sort of place a couple of people in Parliament. I'm one of them, like parliamentary reporters, and we report live from Parliament about policy making. We go to portfolio committees, and that's just to sort of decipher the language and just give an idea to young people what's going on in Parliament.
And how old are you, Rolf? You're like 22, 23?
I'm 24.
24. Is it weird being this sort of young guy, you know, working for a youth magazine, all of a sudden being thrown into Parliament and having to cover issues, you know, where often there's a lot of other journalists covering them and who are much older, and it's often hard to get young people interested in this stuff? How is it being down there as a young person in Parliament?
It's pretty intimidating, to tell you the truth. So, I mean, like, a couple of times you get into a portfolio committee meeting and the language like is just so laced with jargon. You have no idea what they're talking about. And I mean, it can get a bit intimidating. Also, there's also the, you know, the possibility that what we're writing about, you know, is, you know, very foreign to our readers. So they might not be interested in what we're saying at all. But, you know, we do feel like it is something that's important. You know, it's a pretty important topic, the idea of having, you know, being sort of the intermediary between Parliament and young people. So in that sense, I'd say it's pretty exciting. But, yeah, I think it's important. So, yeah, it's pretty fulfilling.
Yeah, I mean, so this is Kingsley here. I'm just curious, how do you sort of go through that divide? How do you make the Parliament issues relevant for young people? Like, what kind of thinking process, or how do you package it?
Okay, cool. So usually the stories we write about, like, so let's end up trying to make the stories really personal. Mm. Like, let's say we're writing about a piece of legislation. We don't want to make it. It's one thing to say the government just signed a piece of legislation and it's going to do A, B, C, and such and such and such. It's another thing to show people how it's going to personally affect them. So I remember, like, for example, there was a story we wrote on substance abuse. There was a portfolio committee. I think it was the Department of Social Development. And one of our writers, Sabelo Mkabela, he found a piece of information. He went to the portfolio committee. And after that, instead of just saying, okay, government's going to do such and such and such and such, he said, he related it to a person. He said, this is what the legislation is going to do. Here's a real person. This is how it's going to affect them. And so that's basically what we do. We try not to take the stories too, you know, high concept and out there. At each point, we always try to make sure that, you know, we give a personal side of the story. We try to show the people we're writing to how it's going to affect them in some sense. And also, there was another story we did, for example, about NASFAS and how the higher education, the Department of Higher Education is going to tackle that. So we talked to real people, found out what they think, told them how that's going to impact them. And I think when you do it in that sense, there's always a very real possibility that people will connect with it when you show them how it's going to affect them personally.
And Rolf, how have you found the response from your readers? Because your target market is quite a young group. Do you find they are engaging with this sort of content on Parliament?
Look, like, to be honest, it's hit and miss. It's hit and miss. There's certain issues that people are always going to relate to. Like education, for example, like the people we write to are still going through tertiary, most of them, like a good portion of them. So if we write about NASFAS, for example, that's always going to be an issue that's going to affect them. If you write about, for example, drug abuse, substance abuse, so there's certain topics that lend themselves to our demographic and they're always going to read about them. The stories that are much harder to sell. Like if you talk about the Department of Telecommunications and how they've just signed a new piece of legislation, sometimes they're not too concerned about that.
Rolf, before we let you go, can you just tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are, because you started with the live team as an intern, am I right? Can you tell us a bit about that stage's progression for our listeners and perhaps say if anyone else listening wants to get involved and perhaps have the same opportunities that you have, how they can do that?
Okay, no, cool, that's sweet. So like you said, I work for Live Magazine. It's sort of like a subsidiary of Liberty Africa. And Live Magazine just focuses on giving internship opportunities to young people, journalists, like we're interested in media, journalism, photography, marketing. So I initially started as an intern, a journalist, and I interned for about 2 months then we were contracted, because we do a lot of contract work. We were contracted by the University of California, if I remember correctly, to do a survey on electoral patterns in South Africa. That was supposed to happen for 2 months. I did that for two, and that was in the build-up to the election. Mm-hmm. So we did that for 2 months. Masters were happy with my work. They gave me, and then after that, you know, I worked on the VIP campaign, which is sort of like I said, youth participation in politics. Worked on that up until December, and yeah, in January I got offered a permanent post. And I mean, like, there are a couple of people who are full-time employees at Liberty Africa now who initially started as journalists, photographers at Live Magazine. So that's just sort of the whole sort of what the company does. It sort of wants to funnel young people into give them opportunities in the media industry, and then sort of funnel them into some paid work at some or other point. I just happened to work for the company. They just like my work so much.
and Rolf, if other young people out there want to get involved with Live Magazine or the Live VIP campaign, how can they do that?
Cool. So you can go to livemag.co.za. That's livemag.co.za. And you can also follow us on Facebook, Live Magazine, and on Twitter at Live Magazine.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Rolf. I'm sure people will be really keen to get in touch. Now, the big question we're all dying to ask is, do you have any big, funny stories from Parliament? Anyone you bump into or anything funny happen over there?
A scuffle with Bladen Zamandi in the halls? Or?
Yeah, I mean, there was one time, I remember the first time we went to Parliament. I don't remember what portfolio committee we were going to. And, I mean, I'm a young guy. I don't wear suits and stuff like that. I'm always, fitted caps, you know. Jeans, sagging jeans and stuff like that. And we bumped into Mandla Mandela.
Okay.
We were wearing our caps in one of the committee meetings. And he just lost it. He was like, do we have no respect? Why don't you take off your cap? I was like, okay, we'll do it, man. Chill. But other than that, yeah, it's there's not that much grandstanding or stuff like that. It's civilized.
I'm guessing you don't wear caps to Parliament anymore.
Nah, I took the hint.
Okay, that's Rafua Mineta. Thank you for joining us on the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central.
Thanks, man.
Cheers. And if you want to get in touch with the Live VIP or Live Magazine campaign, you can look them up online and find out how to get in touch from there. Now, Kingsley, I just want to take the conversation a little bit to some of the work I've done this week for the Daily Maverick. One of the things I've been covering almost since it started is the xenophobic looting that happened in Soweto. Now, yesterday I was in Mayfair, in just sort of one of the inner suburbs just in the west of Joburg. And I was actually pretty shocked to see what was there. You know, we know, I think it's something like 150 stores have been looted now. We know there have been at least six related deaths. The looting has spread from Soweto, from different parts of Soweto to other parts of Gauteng, and even isolated incidents in other provinces. But still, I was shocked when I got to Mayfair and found this place called Princess Street, where a lot of the Somali store owners who've been looted have now fled to. So I got there and, you know, there are all these guys just hanging around either in the park or in the coffee shops and restaurants, and they've just got absolutely nothing to do now. And I was just story after story, and you couldn't avoid speaking to people because everyone wanted to share their stories. Person after person just told me how they conveyed a sense of sort of hopelessness and just really not knowing what they're going to do next. Now that they came to South Africa after fleeing sort of war or tribal violence, you know, with Al-Shabaab in Somalia, and now they're in South Africa and they're fleeing the place where they were taking refuge from the townships. I'm just finding it shocking. I'm not sure if you've been following the story.
I mean, I have. I mean, I find it quite interesting that you led with xenophobic attacks. I think there was a bit of a debate about, is it really xenophobia? Is it just crime? I mean, what do you think of that? Is that just a done deal and it's official?
Well, no, I think certainly there are criminal elements. Someone was telling me yesterday, even someone who seems to be in the know a little bit, that it's led by some criminal elements, young guys, you know, perhaps 20 or 30 or 40 of them, who sort of pick out a store and then they force themselves in. They go straight for the airtime, the cash and the cigarettes, the most valuable things that are in a spaza shop. Then as soon as they get them, they run off, go to the next door and beat the police there and leave the police to deal with just local little kids, you know, trying to steal like a 2-liter cold drink or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's true, but certainly there are criminal elements because it's a crime.
Yeah.
But it is targeted. It's only foreigners that are being targeted. I haven't seen a South African spaza store looted at all. So the question is, a lot of people are saying, is it xenophobia or Afrophobia?
Absolutely.
I've got no doubt that it's one of the two or some mix of what between, but it's certainly not just criminal. And I think that's the bigger thing. And we're an interesting case of this xenophobia, Afrophobia debate, because you're from Kenya.
Yeah.
I'm from Australia. And I never really, no one ever really knows where I'm from, you know. No one sees, they just see me as a white guy when I go to these communities. No one ever knows, no one ever cares, no one asks me anything, generally. But I'd like to know from you, being a Kenyan who works and lives in South Africa, do you have a different experience of perhaps discrimination or prejudice?
I live a pretty middle-class existence, so I can't say that I'm on the forefront of some of these issues that we're facing with the looting that's been going on recently. What I face is pretty much very mild experiences of being spoken to in local languages, so your Zulu, your Tswana, and experiencing a frustration when I can't respond in that language. So it's almost like you're black.
From their side.
Oh, absolutely. You're black, you don't speak these languages, it's a frustration.
Whereas people see me and I'm just another dumb white guy who can only speak English, you know. Occasionally people try to speak Afrikaans to me and I can't. I just keep on saying excuse and then they just get confused even more. So.
But Greg, please share with us some of your business skills. I think one thing that's coming out of this is that foreigners have great business skills. So, I mean, give me something, man. What you got?
I don't think I have any business skills at all. I think I'm going to be an employee for life. Now, I'm not quite your Somalian or Ethiopian or Bangladeshi guys. Those guys seem to really be able to come in here and open businesses. But that's one of the other interesting things that's come out of this looting. And even if perhaps it might even be a silver lining, I don't think we should say there are any silver linings, but it's one of the interesting things that come out of this is people are talking about why do the Somalians and such, why do they own most of these spazas? Why is their bread cheaper? Why are they better at running businesses? And there's different opinions, but some of the consistent answers that keep coming up revolve around their networks and working together. So by all these different spaza shops working together, all these different owners, they buy in bulk. They share transport costs. And we're seeing, what studies have shown is South Africans don't do that as much. So it's just an individual person buying your own, you know, your own bread and maize and everything like that and then selling it for higher prices. Yeah. Whereas all these foreigners seem to be much better equipped at sort of creating cooperatives. And that's one lesson that I think South African small and medium businesses could take from this problem. And I think now government needs to really try and help South African business become more competitive, and particularly at the local level, and improve their business services to not so much to push the foreigners out, but to make sure that South African businesses can be competitive in what is a competitive environment. And one of the things that a lot of people keep on coming back to as well is that during apartheid, businesses in townships and other areas was highly regulated, and it really didn't promote a spirit of, or a strong enough spirit of entrepreneurship and competition. So I think it's government that really has to step in and work hard to help local entrepreneurs.
I mean, absolutely. I think something that I've heard brought up in the past is that amongst a lot of cultures, you have generations upon generations of entrepreneurship experience. So somebody's grandfather or parent or so on was in that industry. So my grandfather owned a restaurant, my dad owned a restaurant, so I know how to do that. Mm. Whereas what is the impact of apartheid on non-white South Africans? Do they have that legacy? Do they have that experience? How many of these people are first-generation business owners trying to figure it out for themselves? So that's really interesting. Mm.
You're listening to Cliff Central. This is the Daily Maverick Show, Greg and Kingsley. We're going to go to a track. Do we have AKA and Burna Boy?
Oh, yeah.
Here we go.
Up to the town, nothing else, I burn a rank in the original Nigerian Don Gargan riding through, man, I ride out, I've been out without a curfew. Longside the one AK compass, still is sure. This a robbery, the whole of them for no sound.
In this four now, time to get them guns and kick your door down. Niggas ain't running anymore now. Bang, bang, everybody kiss the floor now. It's a all eyes on me, yeah.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
It's just after 1:30 and you're listening to the Daily Maverick Show with me, Greg Nicholson, and I'm here with NK Make Your Marks Kingsley Kapuri today. That was AKA and Burna Boy, All Eyes on Me, a bit of a South African Nigerian connection to counter the xenophobia. Now we're going to cross over to our correspondent, Rebecca Davis, who's in Cape Town and has been at the FW de Klerk event today, celebrating the 25 years of the unbanning of political parties. Rebecca, are you there?
I am. How are you, Greg?
I'm well, thank you. Tell us a bit about what's happened today.
Fascinating morning. We just wrapped up, so the timing's very good. The event was held, obviously, to commemorate the 25th anniversary of FW de Klerk's historical announcement of the unbanning of political parties and the release of Nelson Mandela in 1990. And to commemorate the event, the FW de Klerk Foundation had put together a panel of speakers, which included obviously former President F.W. de Klerk himself, mm-hmm. but also former President Kgalema Motlanthe, IFP leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi, and Johan Rupert, the billionaire, and former British ambassador to South Africa, Robin Renwick, who was in his position at the time of the transition to democracy, so had some interesting stories to tell. But a very interesting morning, Jack. I mean, a lot of stuff there that I think would have been quite contentious mm-hmm. to a lot of black Africans in particular.
From F.W. de Klerk, do you mean?
F.W. de Klerk obviously said, for instance, that he didn't ask for the honor of a street being named after him, but he accepted it. But Mangosuthu Buthelezi, for instance, said that he was shocked and horrified by any kind of condemnation of the naming of a street after F.W., after, quote, what he did for us, which I think is a statement that will take some following for some people. Kgalema Motlanthe also coming out in defense of the decision to name the road after F.W. de Klerk, saying that he thought Ahmed Kathrada's view on it, which we obviously published on the Daily Maverick 2 days ago, was the correct one. And when challenged on the comments of ANC Western Cape leader Tony Ehrenreich, who delivered some bitter criticism of the decision, he said that next he encountered Ehrenreich, he would tell him how mistaken his reasoning was. Really? So really a kind of, I wouldn't say love fest, but, you know, a lot of warm admiration expressed for F.W. de Klerk, obviously, given the nature of the arrangement, mm-hmm. but very little pushback against the notion that F.W. de Klerk acted out of purely moral reasons, that there was no pragmatism in his decision, that his was a moral decision.
That's quite fascinating, because I think the whole issue around the naming of the road in Cape Town is obviously about that question as to whether everyone knows F.W. de Klerk made this announcement 25 years ago and he did play a role in the transition, but he was also a National Party leader and apartheid president. Did he ever, while speaking today, acknowledge some of perhaps the wrongs, or did anyone point out some of the wrongs that he might have done or his party might have done or taken part in?
Certainly nobody made any mention of F.W. de Klerk's history prior to becoming president, not as education minister, or his, as you say, fairly interesting part in the National Party. He himself stressed repeatedly it was a moral decision to dismantle apartheid, and he really sought to refute the notion that his back was against the wall, as people often say, that he had no other options. And, he wasn't challenged on this. Kgalema Motlanthe's line was a sort of diplomatic one, where he said that there can be little doubt that F.W. de Klerk met the needs of history at that time. I think he said in slightly loftier language, mm-hmm. Which obviously isn't a very glowing endorsement, but it's a kind of straightforward statement. Mm-hmm. And from the likes of Johan Rupert, obviously an old friend of F.W. de Klerk, you know, some really glowing stuff, him saying, for instance, that F.W. de Klerk had enabled Afrikaners to hold their heads up high for the first time in a long while, and so forth. And Robin Renwick certainly also coming out to really praise F.W. de Klerk's decision.
It was a love fest.
It was a bit of a love fest. It was a bit of a love fest, which was interesting. And also another interesting point, Greg, was obviously a lot of concern expressed about recent racial incidents. There was a general, pretty much every speaker mentioned concerns about social cohesion in South Africa currently. But Motlanthe coming out specifically to single out social media, which we've seen from the ANC recently, when Bladen Zamanda was also talking about the tenor of the comment sections on South African news outlets being very racist.
It seems like someone just got a smartphone. Someone's distributed smartphones throughout the ANC.
I think that might be right. Internet has come to Lutuli House and they've wisened up. And yeah, he was saying that the cyberspace racism is a real concern, and particularly that they were alarmed by the number of bloggers and commenters and whatnot who were espousing racist views who seemed to be very young. I should note that this was in sort of direct contradiction to what Johan Rupert later said on an optimistic note, where he said he felt hopeful about the future of South Africa because he was convinced that the next generation had no hang-ups in the way that the current and older ones did. He said that, you know, he was painting a picture of young South Africa as being entirely kind of colorblind and non-racial in a way that his generation wasn't. And, of course, Motlanthe's comments sort of contradicting that way. He was saying, look at all these people expressing this horrifying racism and they're all really young. What's that about?
It's a little bit hard to judge the pulse of a nation when you're a billionaire, I think. But Rebecca, so F.W. de Klerk, I saw that he made some comments about the current state of the country and the country's progress. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And did it sound like it was a bit of in contradiction or sort of a talking back to President Zuma's comments that, you know, things like Eskom's problems, that's apartheid's fault?
You know, Eskom came in for a bit of a thing, and I must say in particular from Robin Renwick, whose views were sort of interesting because as the former ambassador to British ambassador during that time, he first of all has this long history of South Africa. But second of all, his role on the panel was to tell South Africans what the current international perception of South Africa is. And he was saying that one of the most basic critical tests of a country is, can you switch the lights on and do they stay on? And he assumed that the problems of electricity in this country are causing, you know, real alarm from investors and real alarm from friends. And he said he was recently asked by a prominent investor whether the wheels were coming off in South Africa. So he was quite focused on the electricity crisis as being sort of seen internationally as emblematic of greater problems. F.W. de Klerk, to his credit, actually did not focus on the electricity thing very much. He said at the end that his was a glass half full approach to current South Africa, but that he thought it would be, quote, a rough 5 years. So clearly not a lot of time for the current administration. And in fact, a little bit awkward, I thought, that so many of the speakers, or the likes of Johan Rupert, for instance, really giving Jacob Zuma's government a bash and Zuma himself, while Khalema Motlanthe sort of sat there and took it and, you know, applauded politely.
So, sorry, that was that there. You said they were criticizing Jacob Zuma.
Yeah, exactly. And criticizing elements of his policy and Khalema Motlanthe, you know, just sort of sitting there applauding politely. Rupert said that sad to the teachers' union, that sad to had to be kind of neutered, that the government had to do something about that. And, you know, Motlanthe stood there and, you know, applauded. I just think that he is perhaps a very polite man, but he's, you know, a very diplomatic character.
He's never wanted to really act out of turn.
I think that's right, yeah.
During his comments, was because he hasn't been speaking very much in public since the 2012 Mungong ANC election race. Did his comments have the sort of former ring of one of these, you know, former ANC presidents or leaders who perhaps have gone into the twilight and now can sort of say whatever they want but still keep some grace? Or did he sound like he was very much, and I'm talking about Motlanthe, did he sound like he was very much still involved in politics and looking to take an active part?
Yeah, it's a good question. He didn't actually ever comment on his current status, although other panelists made reference to him being a senior member of the ANC, obviously. There was no point at which he seemed to let loose and diverge from official government line, except if perhaps you take those comments about F.W. de Klerk naming to be contradictory to the ANC and the Western Cape. I don't think anyone in the ANC really goes out to bat for the Western Cape leaders because they're so often seen as kind of mavericks anyway. There certainly wasn't any sense that there was this newly liberal Motlanthe, you know. He gave a very lofty speech packed with, you know, quotes from Einstein and Churchill and God knows who else. And, but I didn't get the sense that, you know, there was this Mbeki, like, this untethered statesman now who can let loose. I was interested to see actually that, and this might well be common knowledge, but I didn't know that F.W. de Klerk is part of a group of, I don't want to say Illuminati, but of a former world president who gives, quote, discreet advice to
the
president.
There we go. Reported first on Daily Maverick by Rebecca Davis.
You heard it here first.
F.W. de Klerk is the head of the Illuminati. Rebecca?
I'd be curious to see those behind doors.
Rebecca, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks for talking to us. That's Rebecca Davis,
no
Daily Maverick journalist, speaking in Cape Town after the F.W. de Klerk Foundation event today. On the line, I think still in KwaZulu-Natal, we have Ranjini Munasami, our Daily Maverick journalist. Ranjini.
Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you? How are you?
I'm fine. How are you having fun?
I'm good, thanks. So I'm here with Kingsley Kapuri from NK Make Your Mark. And you wrote quite an interesting article this week looking, sort of analysing the ANC and some of its actions in the last few years, particularly after the death of Jackie Celebi. Can you just sort of break that down for us? Because reading it, you sort of get the feeling that the ANC is eating its own, and then once they're gone, they're trying to rewrite history.
Yes, you know, it's been quite remarkable to observe the course of events since the death of Jackie Celebi. You know, he he was quite a controversial figure since he became the National Police Commissioner. And then after the allegations of corruption emerged against him in the mid-2000s. And his corruption trial was quite astounding in terms of the allegations that emerged and his performance on the stand. And I think during that time, from what emerged in court, it was quite obvious that Celebi didn't have any kind of good explanation for why he did what he did. So in the wake of his death, there's now been claims that he was part of some kind of intelligence operation which led him to associate with the drug dealer and underground figure Glenn Angliotti. But more than that, at the funeral, we had claims by the NC's Jesse Duarte and former President Thabo Mbeki basically saying that, the NPA was vindictive in pursuing the prosecution against Celebi and that there is more to it which needs to be investigated and that he was a hero, not a villain. This is the reason I wrote the piece is because, yes, Celebi did have quite an outstanding reputation and contribution to the liberation struggle. But during his corruption trial, there was an attempt by a former President Mbeki to protect him from prosecution, but mm-hmm. during the corruption trial, there was absolutely no attempt by the ANC to weigh in and say, look, we have other alternate information, that the prosecution is not justifiable or anything of the sort. It's quite bizarre that they would wait until the person is dead and then ask for the NPA to investigate it. But it goes to the bigger picture of the wars within the ANC and how it plays out through state institutions. At the moment, we have the case of the Hawks boss, Anwar Dramat. And, it's the rather bizarre pursuit of him by the police minister and the various attempts to suspend him. And now there's a claim that they're actually trying to pay him out for him to take early retirement. And it makes no sense why somebody who seems committed to their job and who has a formidable reputation in the ANC would suddenly be pursued for allegations that ostensibly have not been proven in a court of law, that is on the illegal rendition of for Zimbabwean nationals. So it seems rather strange as to why there's this pursuit of Anwar Dramat. But there are many more examples, and the other example is that of Ivan Pillay, who's a deputy commissioner at the South African Revenue Service. Ivan Pillay as well has, he has an uncontested legacy in the liberation struggle. He was, and he continued to do good service to the South African government afterwards. And then there are these allegations that come up against him. It has not been proven in any way, but there is this dogged pursuit of him, to try and get rid of him. It has happened so many times over the past few years that you found that there's been a deluge of senior officials who come from the ANC and who serve the South African state, but then they get caught up in the infighting. They get accused of being part of one faction or the other or not being loyal to the current administration, and then they get hounded out. Mm. And some of them do go quietly, and then others, like Dramat and Pillay, are fighting for their survival. But then what is the point, It seems, Greg, that the only time that these people would then be appreciated is when they die, and then some other ANC official comes and speak and then, claims their legacy. But in life,
they seem to have no problem with sort of making up very hard to believe claims, when they die, but then they never brought such claims, when they're alive.
Yeah, during their lives. But this is the thing. And then, the ANC, that's why it becomes its own worst enemy. These are people who are doing service to the state, which the ANC runs. There are so many others who are facing a range of allegations, who are dragged before the court, who don't get pursued, who don't get hounded out of their jobs. In fact, they're protected, and the reason they get protected is because they are part of you know, the in crowd, the ruling political elite. So they get the special rules. So, you know, and the thing is that there's no consistency as well. When Tony Engeni, the former ANC chief whip and now National Executive Committee member, was convicted of corruption, the ANC escorted him to prison. There were high-level members, including the Speaker of Parliament, who took him to Paul's Mall prison and waited for him to go inside, you know, and they gave him a hero's farewell. When Celebi went to prison, or, well, to prison hospital, he went as a sad, lonely man and was basically abandoned by the ANC. And now, all of a sudden, you know, there's a complete revision of his legacy, and suddenly, you know, he gets the ANC flag draped over his coffin, and, you know, a litany of ANC officials singing his praises. So, you know, they make a mockery of the ANC, and they make a mockery of the South African public. Because, and they haven't said in all these explanations or, you know, that have come forth now, they're not saying whether it was false that Celebi accepted money from Glenn Agliotti or not. Was that false? You know, did he not accept the money? Did the NPA make up those allegations? So were the facts that were presented in court false? This is what needs to be tested, because if there was an unfair pursuit of him by the National Prosecuting Authority, or if he was part of some intelligence operation, why was this not raised in court? You know, this is the thing. And, you know, the ANC is supposed to be a leader in our society. Its members, its deployees in government are meant to be setting an example. You don't have somebody in the level or at the level of the National Police Commissioner then in being involved in such serious corruption, being convicted by a high court, the conviction being confirmed by the Supreme Court of Appeal, and then all of a sudden, at the funeral, they say, oh, no, no, none of that was valid because he was, in fact, a hero. What message does that send out to the South African public? And I don't think the ANC has an answer for that.
And it's been interesting in this period when it seems like the ANC and its allies have been, perhaps because of the criticism of Jackie Celebi, a lot of people want to tear his legacy down, but it's like they don't look at him as a complex individual with a strong struggle history and a lot of service to the state. But they seem to just sort of hold up the positive, as well as the corruption side. They just seem to hold up the positives of Jackie Celebi and completely try to ignore that stuff rather than acknowledge both positive and negative.
Yes, I mean, you don't get, with everyone in society, you don't get a completely bad person or a completely good person. You get people who do good things for society, and then they make mistakes, and sometimes those mistakes are illegal, and they have to face the consequences from the law. And this is the thing about Celebi. He is a very divisive and a very complex figure. For that very reason, because he clearly, you know, made a tremendous contribution to society, to democracy in South Africa, but also on an international level with his work at the United Nations and with Interpol. So, you know, he is appreciated and at that level, and rightly so. But if he committed a crime while in the position of while in a very high profile position, which is meant to root out crime, then you know, then he needs to face the consequences for that, which he did. He was convicted, and that conviction you know, confirmed by the Supreme Court of Appeal. So it's rather bizarre why the ANC didn't make any of this information public previously, or with the former head of state, he would have had all this information before him. He had asked that South Africa trust him, that Celebi had done nothing untoward, and you know, he suspended the former head of the NPA to prevent him from prosecuting Celebi. So he had a range of information before him, which he did not share with the public, and which he's indicating he will make public now. And the question to be asked is, why didn't the former President Mbeki make this information public all along? What was he waiting for?
Absolutely.
Surely it's in the national interest for us to have a national prosecuting authority that is above reproach, and surely, you know, he has a duty to share this information. So, you know, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors in this entire saga, and there's a lot of questions to be asked about the ANC as to when he sends his deployees into the state, what is his instruction? Is it there to protect just the politically powerful, or are they there to do their jobs?
That's good, actually, Ranjini, on that. We're getting a very bleak picture of sort of the ANC and the state of governance from this conversation and your article. So I'm just wondering, is there any sort of light at the end of the tunnel? Is there a way the ANC can self-correct itself from this?
Look, Kenji, I think, you know, the ANC is, the South Africa functions. There are many, many good people in the ANC and deployed into the state who keep the wheels of the country turning. It is not all rubbish, you know. It's just that there are some high-profile figures who abuse their positions and who compromise the state in the way they behave, the way they conduct themselves. And, you know, because of the networks, the patronage networks that promote and the abuse of power. But by and large, I think there are a lot of good. There is a lot of good work that is being done. And I think, you know, it's incumbent on the ANC to make sure that for its own image, for it's 103 years old, you know, for it to be sustainable, for South Africa to be able to turn the corner on this really bad period we're going through with the electricity crisis, with the economic crisis, that, you know, it ensures that the people who are deployed in the state do their jobs and do it well, without any kind of corruption creeping in. And I think that they are not sending out that message clearly. I think that with these recent examples of Dramas and Pele, they are sending completely the wrong message, where they're saying that you toe the line or you get hounded out. And I think that will instill fear in the people that they have in the state, you know, to just keep their head down and to follow political instructions rather than doing what the Constitution and the law requires them to do.
Ranjini, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us. That's Daily Maverick correspondent Ranjini Munasamy from KZN.
My pleasure, Greg.
Thank you. You're listening to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. My name's Greg Nicholson, and thank you to Kingsley Kapuria from NK Make Your Mark, who's been in the studio with me. Kingsley, how do people get in touch with NK if they want to?
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Greg. In terms of reaching us at NK, our website is nk.co.za. We're also on Facebook and Twitter as at NKMYM and NK Make Your Mark on Facebook. Thanks a lot.
And thanks to Rafael Mineta from Live VIP Campaign and Rebecca Davis, who was also on the line today. See you next week.